KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10:59 a.m. Coming up at 11, the Digital Divide. Here's from experimental electronic music artist Christy Denton. And as you heard, KBOO is building a city of media makers. Finding, recruiting, training up the next generation of media makers. What do they call them? Culture workers and DJs. Cultural ambassadors. Curators of the Media Museum, a living, breathing, dynamic, and active museum of culture and media that brings you the culture, arts, news and entertainment, and analysis and information. kboo.fm/Kickstarter. That's where you can get involved. That's where you can back the Kickstarter campaign, which needs your support today. Build a strong infrastructure for the next generation of media makers. kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Join with your friends and neighbors in making sure that everyone has something to hear and a way to hear it. Join up with your neighbors Lisa, a couple of anonymous neighbors, and Fran, Eric, and Gila. kboo.fm/Kickstarter. I promised you the Digital Divide, and that's going to start in just a moment.
Rabia Yemen with the Digital Divide. Today I'm talking with Christy Denton, a Portland-based composer, sound installation and electronic artist who works with found sounds, electronics, homemade and modified instruments. She has a degree in music composition from Mills College and a graduate certificate from the Center of Creation Music in France. Christy has built giant chimes as part of the Music for People and Thingamajigs Festival. Just the name makes me want to go to the Thingamajigs Festival. And amplified exhibits in the Exploratorium. That's in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, it is.
Welcome to the Digital Divide, Christy Denton.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I really want to start at the beginning. You have a formal education in music.
Yes.
Did you start learning an instrument or learning music as a child, as a young child?
So when I was a kid, my parents, we lived in a little tiny town on the eastern side of the Sierra. My dad played the hammer dulcimer, my mom played the fiddle, and they played in a square dance band, and I thought that was fantastic. Somebody played a flute, and at some point decided that I really wanted to play the flute, so I wanted to play the fiddle, but my mom insisted that was a bad idea because then you didn't get to be in marching band when you got to high school, and I was going to want to be in marching band, so I learned to play the flute, you know, went to high school, joined marching band, that was great fun. Went to Interlochen, which is in high school for a little bit, and that's a performing arts school in Michigan. And I actually at some point switched from flute to bassoon, and I actually went for bassoon, but I decided at some point that the composition classes were much more interesting than playing stuff, in part because I kind of hate performing. And if you're a composer, then you don't, you know, you get to create all this stuff, but you give it to somebody else to perform.
Is that because you have stage fright?
Yeah, totally huge. It's great being on the radio because, you know, that's kind of performing.
It's a safe place.
Yeah. And I did a little bit of electronic music and computer music and such, but mostly I was doing, you know, straight up orchestration with flutes and violins and, you know, full on orchestra stuff. And at some point that just wasn't, you know, went to college, kind of Mills College has a wonderful electronic music program that the Center for Contemporary Music.
When was that? When did you attend Mills?
I started in 94.
So if they had a program in electronic music in 1994, it must have been still somewhat newish.
I believe it started in like the 60s or something. It was like one of the very first. They started out of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And then Mills College took it over, and Mills College is in Oakland, not in San Francisco. So they kind of, you know, San Francisco Tape Music Center with great composers like Pauline Oliveros. They were doing weird experimental electronic music right at the very beginning of doing weird experimental electronic music. And so being at Mills was a good place. And I was 18, 19. I wasn't, most of the people in the program were grad students and such. And, you know, I was kind of a little bit, had just sort of ended up there randomly to some degree, you know.
That's remarkable. So when we talk about electronic music now, my first exposure to electronic music was through a computer.
Yeah.
And, you know, various programs. I think it kind of started for us when we brought an Amiga home. I brought an Amiga home, mm-hmm. which was really an exciting computer at the time, maybe more for video than audio, but it really did everything. But, you know, the idea of like thinking about doing electronic or experimental music on tape, I think we forget that, you know, mm-hmm. that the people who really started experimental music, that it does go to the 60s and even before then.
Yeah.
But we are so acclimated to the computer, we forget that it existed before then. So were you like splicing and...
I did splice tape, and I took a tape splicing class. Yeah, I was going to say I haven't spliced tape since then, but actually I'm working on a project that has tape splicing in it right now, so that's a lie.
Well, tell me about that project.
It's not working very well, but I'm working on a piece where I'm taking apart cassette tapes and making a large wall. Not a large wall right now. It's only 2 feet by 3 feet of tape, and then building tape heads so that you can take your tape head wand and record and re-record on the wall, so you can come by and you can, you know, somebody can come by and record something onto the tape, and somebody else can come by and see if they can listen to it.
How do they record onto it?
Because you have one tape head, with a cassette tape, you know, for all those people who are familiar with cassette tapes, you have the record head, you know.
So people can walk up to, there's actual tape.
Yep.
And how do they How do they put the noise or the sound on it?
So right now, it doesn't work very well. You'd have a microphone or something that you would be talking into, and then you'd have, what right now it's a wand-like thing that you're rubbing on the wall, and you're picking a speed, you're going fast or slow over the wall, and drawing on this.
Is this an actual surface?
Yep, an actual surface that you can essentially draw on, and then somebody can come by later with headphones and essentially listen to it.
Are we going to have video of this someday when it's working? Because I think people need to see this to really understand the concept of it.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, it would be fun to do it as an installation someplace, to set it up. And you kind of need, what I kind of want to do is set it up on a wall and then have people come along and tell it secrets. You know, you tell it things you wouldn't tell anybody, and you put them on the wall.
We have a radio show for that. You know?
And then you come by and see if you can listen. I mean, it's so hard to pick anything up when you're listening. Occasionally people will be able to, you know, pick up a random phrase or something, but they won't be able to quite hear the whole thing.
Well, that's okay, though. That's the idea.
Right.
I love that. It's interactive and participatory, so it has all the things I like. And
it's sort of like throwing a message into a bottle into the ocean, like with a secret in it. Like, you know, is anybody ever going to really find it out?
Or hear it? Yeah. I love it. That's fantastic. So after Mills, what were you working with at the end of that period?
I was still working with a lot of, I was doing some amount of experimental and electronic stuff. Well, I mean, I was working with a lot of more traditional instruments still at that point. I rarely work with them now. I'd say it was about 50-50 working with more traditional instruments. And so I really started to get more into just working with experimental things when I started traveling more. And I could bring my laptop with me, but I couldn't really bring a cello player with me. You know, I could bring my laptop, I could bring small toys and small tools, but I couldn't really rely on handing what I was working on over to somebody else. I could, you know, bring a suitcase and devote a quarter of the suitcase to my stuff.
Priorities.
Yeah. And then I also
realized... Who needs shoes when yeah. you can make noise?
I don't need shoes. I don't like shoes very much. Then I realized I also like... As you can probably tell from the story I've just told about the tape wall thing, I really like breaking things and things that don't quite work and trying to make them work. I use MaxMSP, which is a visual programming language, and a lot of what I end up doing is rebuilding things that I could actually find some other, you know, somebody has already built a tool to do that, and I will rebuild the tool, and my tool will be halfway broken. And my
does that help you understand it better?
I think so.
Because I think that for some people, like, that's just their process. It's, you know, the person who has to build the clock to be able to tell you what time it is. Well, I need to understand how this clock works really before I can tell you what time it is, even though I can see what time it is.
Right, exactly. That's kind of what it is. And there's also so many other things that you learn from doing that. I mean, there's so many times when I go and I try to build thing A and I end up with thing B, and that's not what I expected, but thing B gives results that are interesting and not what I expected, and I like that a lot. You know, I try to build a clock and I end up with a microwave. Oops, you know.
I can kind of relate. I would rather build something than use the something. If I build something, let's say like a database, then when I'm done, I don't really so much want to use it. I want to, and it's weird because I don't really think of myself this way, but since I was a child, go out and, you know, build a cave for dolls. And then after the cave is built, I'm like, yeah, I don't feel like playing anymore.
Right.
And I'm still like that, but with different tools. Would you say that that describes how you...
Yeah,
nature. I think it's a nature thing.
I want to be the architect. I don't want to be the... After I'm done with things, I like to still have them around, but it's more fun to go do the next thing than it is to redo the previous thing.
I really, really get that. But when you were done with school, And then you say, well, I've had all this education. Gee, now what am I going to do?
Well, it turns out the higher you go in music, the higher education you have in music, the less likely you are to have a job, apparently.
Yeah.
So I have a real day job that doesn't involve music at all.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's sad, but it pays the bills. So I went to Mills, then I worked at a software company for a few years, and then I went off to the Center for Contemporary Music, Yannis Xenakis, in France. Yannis Xenakis was an architect and musician who liked to combine architecture and music, and there was a school that focused on architecture sometimes and focused on music at other times. And he had built this instrument called the UPIC, and UPIC stands for something, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but...
We'll Google it.
Yep. and it's this instrument where you draw things, and then that becomes the music. And he built, I don't know how many of them he actually built. I know that there's two, maybe three of them still left in existence. And one of them was at the school, and the one that was at, one is in a museum, one was at the school.
And what is it? We were talking about the it, but I have no idea what it is.
It's a large tablet that connects to a computer.
All right.
And yeah, it's a music making device, an instrument.
It's a digital device?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, the one that was at the school worked some years and did not work other years, and this was one of the rare years that they had gotten it to work again. So I managed to create a bunch of music from it, which it's not great music, but it's one of the few things that got recorded on it in the last 20 years. So because of that, there's like the UPIC Wikipedia page, and they're like, okay, so here's an example of it, you know, and it's my music that comes up. Or if they're doing a radio show, they're like, and here's an example of what this instrument sounds like, and they use my stuff.
Is that thrilling?
It's thrilling. I wish I'd done a better job with what I'd done with it. You know, now when I'm re-listening to it.
Well, sure. Retrospect.
I'm like, I didn't know this was going to be the thing that, you know,
it's probably not so much the music as the fact that you're able to produce something from it.
Right.
Regardless of, you know, quality is probably not one of the criteria.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I went to school, worked on that instrument for a bit, stayed in France, met my partner who at the time was working as an aid worker, working in China, working in Sri Lanka. And so I went to China with him, and that was when I sort of realized that, like, I couldn't bring a cello player with me. I couldn't, you know, I got to limit myself to a smaller box.
That suitcase again?
Yeah. And I enjoy that, you know, I enjoy that a lot.
What is your favorite, you know, portable, mobile recording device these days?
Well, I've got a really nice Sony, I can't remember what it is, but I've got a really nice recording device. And what?
Like a handheld device?
A really nice, yeah, handheld device. And of course, it's not very big. It's, you know, as big as a, it's like 5 or 6 inches by 2 or 3 inches by 4 inches.
Yeah.
But I don't carry that with me all the time.
You don't have it with you right now.
Exactly. I have my phone with me, so
sure.
I feel like Leibowitz, the photographer, says
Leibowitz,
that,
yes.
Leibowitz says that her favorite camera is her iPhone because she's always carrying it, so she uses that. And I use my iPhone to record tons and tons of stuff because that's what I have with me.
What's your favorite iPhone app for recording?
It's just iRecorder.
No kidding.
It's just, you know, what's handy, what's there, what's...
Okay.
You know, so, and there's, I mean, that's not the best thing to use, but it's the easiest to grab and get to and,
yeah,
you know, just start with.
Right, because on the handhelds, there's starting it, there's making sure there's charged or there's batteries. There's a number of tests you have to go through for... to be able to use it, and it's heavy.
Yeah, and nothing ever, you know, you never hear those really cool sounds. I mean, not that you never hear those really cool sounds, but you'll be walking down the street or down the beach or down, you know, in a standing in the hall in a radio station, and you'll hear a really cool sound and you'll think, I want to record that
sound. I want that sound.
You know, oh, I'll run back to my room and get the, you know, get the recording device. That.
Do you think of yourself as a sound collector?
Sure. I'm not a very good sound librarian. I have shoeboxes full of old tapes and things like that, and I need to go back through and listen to them and, you know, chop them up. And I tend to, when I've got a performance coming up, grab a whole bunch of things and start listening and pulling things off.
So when you perform and you're performing live in front of people,
mm-hmm.
what does that look like?
So stuff I've been doing lately, I've been taking a guitar, and I don't know how to play guitar, but I've been taking a guitar, and
anyone can play guitar, but well, you know, making, not playing it, that's the talent.
Yes. I'm taking the string sounds that are coming from it and recording them into using a Motu, a digital audio interface to put them onto my computer and then manipulate those sounds with MaxMSP, which is the visual programming language. So what it looks like when I'm performing is that my computer is doing all of the work and I am barely touching this guitar, and yet there's a lot of sound that's occurring because, yeah, what it sounds like
is multiple channels of other sounds that you've brought along with. So you have some pre-recorded sounds, and then you're in your live performance, you're adding in live sounds
right
to the pre-recorded.
Yeah.
So you're making an unpredictable mix.
Yes. Well, I mean, I like to think I can predict it, but I think part of the fact, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the fact that I've built it, and, you know, one of the things that's fun about it is that things aren't always predictable,
right?
Or maybe it's not fun, but it's maybe the way I work best is to not have the predictability.
And so you have your equipment, you have a guitar, you have various sounds that are playing on your laptop or whatever device you have, and that's your composition.
Yes.
And you're and how are you capturing that?
So that can just be recorded on your computer. You know, I can record it. I can send it to a soundboard and record it that way, or I can just record it as a sound file onto my computer. Sometimes I don't record them at all. Sometimes you only get them
in the moment.
Yeah.
And it's not captured. It's happening. And maybe if somebody else is recording, you could look back, but you might not actually be able to say, what just happened?
Right, right. Yeah.
So that's kind of exciting, you know, because it's spontaneous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, one of the other things I've done a lot of is work with audience interaction. So, for example, Heather Perkins, who's a composer in Portland that I went to Mills with her, only she was a grad student when I was an undergraduate. She started a group called Electric Gals. We haven't had a show in the last few years, but we've done a few festivals together where we've invited women electronic composers and had a show up at Disjecta or shows in town, various shows in town. One of the things I did in Electrical show a few years ago was to found an iPhone app that people could download. The iPhone app was a MIDI, sent MIDI data, so everybody could download this free app that had a bunch of buttons on it, and it would send MIDI data. And then one of the other things it would do is it had a gyroscope on it, so you could hold your phone like this, so the entire audience can sit there and control the music by rotating their phone around.
Now, where's it sending the sound to?
So it's sending it all to my computer.
Via Bluetooth?
You're all on the Wi-Fi network.
Oh, via Wi-Fi. Okay.
You know, it worked.
Is everybody a different track?
Yep, everybody was different. They were different numbers. So there were only like 20 people who actually did this, so probably an audience of 100 or so, but you know, 20 people downloaded the app, connected to the network, and sat there. And so they're coming in as channel one, this person is coming in as channel two, and it's sending different MIDI notes. And I'm taking that information and using that to control the music. But of course, the problem is that I've taken into account that everybody's going to play with their gyroscope, and you know, but after 2 or 3 minutes of doing that, everybody just takes their phone and they stick it up in front of their face, and the gyroscope, you know, everybody's gyroscope goes to the exact same location,
right?
And so kind of broke down after, as soon as everybody did
stop gyroscoping.
Exactly. I was talking to another musician friend about all of this and having the problems with having the audience control things, because you don't know what the audience is going to do. And his reaction to all of this was, why on earth would you have the audience involved in your show? That's crazy. Who knows what they'd do, you know?
I love it. I think that's really exciting, though. I mean, you don't have to do it all the time.
Yeah.
But, right? You don't have to always have the audience participating, but having other people participate in that way.
Yeah.
Once or something, that's exciting, because you don't know what's going to happen until after you do it. You can't say, well, the audience will then, you know, I just know what they're going to do, because you don't. You can't.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
The unpredictability of people. Everybody's going to come up with a different thing. You know, you hand someone a toy, everybody's going to look at it in a different way. No one's going to take it and do exactly the same thing with it.
What did you think about the results of that?
I learned a lot of stuff. Everybody was happy with it. Everybody liked that they could play with it.
The audience was really excited. You have a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because you're a composer. And so whatever your anticipation or expectations or projections were about what might happen may or may not match what really happened. So your reaction is, I can see where an audience would be very enthusiastic about that, and where you as the creator would be like, okay, that was interesting.
Well, and I always want to make things better. Like every single performance I ever have, I'm always, my end thought is always, how can I fix these? You know, I want to make this better. You know, now that I've done this, I've learned this and this and this. But you're also stuck with that moment in time of when the show, that was the audience's perception of it.
Right.
I can't, you know, that iPhone, there's similar iPhone apps, but that iPhone app doesn't even work anymore, you know? So I can't recreate that experience, but better anymore. But in my head, I'm like, well, if I do it again, I'd do it. I'd add all of these other things.
Right. I'm Rabia Yaman. This is The Digital Divide, and we're talking with Christy Denton, Portland-based composer and electronic artist. So when you are editing digitally, what are your favorite tools?
I used to use Pro Tools a lot. I haven't been using it lately. I've been doing a lot of things using Max MSP and writing little programs that are doing things badly themselves.
And what made you put distance between yourself and Pro Tools?
It's an expensive piece of software. They upgrade it frequently.
Requires continuous investment.
Yeah, continuous investment. And I had the hardware that went along with it that became outdated. Yeah.
And so when you're programming, like, that is a whole new idea for this person of programming a script, I assume, that will alter sound in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to have a script for every type of alteration you want to make.
Well, you can kind of reuse things. I mean, you can reuse, you know, generally how I work is I go, okay, I want to do this thing here. What's something that I've written that's similar to that thing there? And then I go and find that thing that I wrote 10 years ago, pull it out, you know, bring it over, modify it so it does the thing I want it to do.
Give me an example of, like, what effect What type of effect would a script that you might write?
One of the things I've been working on with the guitar is it's taking a little tiny snippet of sound. You know, the sound goes into the program, takes mm-hmm. a little tiny snippet of it, and then it just delays it just for a little second and repeats it, and delays it for a little second and repeats it, and it does that. Right now, it does it about 24 times. So you have a guitar sound, but it sounds like falling water. You know, and it's not that difficult of a modification. You're not, I mean, that's just a simple delay, repeat sort of
Sure,
thing.
I'll just go make one.
You don't have to. You can just simple. Copy my code.
Okay.
But one of the things, this Maxim SP has new updates to it all the time. And so I've been programming it since 1990. And so I have tools that, you know, when I'm copying my code, I'm going back to things that I wrote sometime. I mean, you know, occasionally back to 1990.
Wow.
I have a friend who's a professor at PCC teaching this. And, you know, he was looking at something I wrote the other day. And he's like, wow, that's a really complicated way to write this one simple thing that could have been done in one word, you know.
Well, like, now.
Right.
But not 1990.
Yeah, that's
right.
Good. Yeah. And it was great. Now I know a new thing because he was looking at my code that I should build more stuff around. It kind of looks a little bit like an architectural drawing. You can kind of, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Drag things in and...
If you have a show at the Ace Hotel, that show is going to have already happened by the time this airs, which
yes.
This will air in the second Friday in February.
Mm-hmm.
So that will already have happened. Tell us about that show and what people can expect to see and hear.
There's a local producer in town, Sounds et al., and he's doing a monthly show at the Ace Hotel on the first Thursday of every month. And I'm going to be there February 1st. But what I'm doing is, it's in the Ace Hotel lobby, and there's a large table in the Ace Hotel lobby, and I have 8 little tiny Bluetooth speakers that I'm going to put on each side of that table. And then there's also the 2 big speakers that, and that'll have other sound going through it. So there'll be 10 different channels of sound. 8 of them will be kind of weak sound, and 2 of them will be, you know, the main sound. I don't know if I'm going to get it to work or not, because this is how I work. But I've got all of these little tiny piezo microphones that I'm building right now, which are little tiny discs that look like quarters that are wired up to a digital audio interface. And I'm putting them around in little boxes around the space so that they'll pick up random little noise, like anybody moving their feet or tapping or scratching or anything else. And I'm also going to put little bells around so that there's additional noise. And so those sounds will be picked up. And so, like, this one little speaker over here will be sending sound out to that other speaker over there. And so on. And then also there's going to be some amount of sounds that are just rotating around the table. So you'll hear things going, you know, just sort of traveling around the table.
That's fantastic. Will there be any, you know, pre-existing sounds added in, or will it only be live what is happening then?
If I get it to work, there won't be any pre-existing sounds added in. I'm not sure I can get it to work, so I'm going to say there's probably going to be some amount of pre-existing sounds added in.
Your plan B.
Right. Right now, I still have this weekend to get it working, so it's possible.
That's a little bit of pressure.
It's how I normally... I don't know why.
It's your process.
That's how I normally work. And if I have things done too soon, I tend to get distressed with them and, you know, decide that I need to
break them.
Yeah, break them.
And then fix them again.
Exactly.
I get it.
So I know the night before the show I will be frantically doing something that was totally fine last week. So
who influences you?
I'd say that my Pauline Oliveros was one of my professors, and then also one of my big influences. I always find myself listening to Anaya Lockwood. She's amazing, and she's just got so many cool projects out there. She, for example, she took a whole bunch of pianos and recorded them, you know, underwater or burning up. I just love that. That's great fun.
Again, that is so fascinating because that is creating sound or art, I'll say sound, that you could never replicate it exactly a second time.
So I have two stories related to that. One, I decided I wanted to burn a piano up because I really wanted to hear what it sounded like. So I posted an ad on Craigslist saying, I'm looking for a free piano and I don't want it to be a good piano. I want a horrible piano. I want a piano that...
You can burn up.
That you are okay with me destroying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does anybody, you know, I'll move it, you know. And I got so many responses from people who were just like, I've had this piano sitting in my backyard for 20 years. Please come get it, you know. Or my house caught fire and this was my family's piano and so we saved it. But now we've realized that we really shouldn't have saved it. That was a bad idea. And so we eventually picked the one that was closest to us, which was one that had been sitting on somebody's porch for 20 years and got it home and realized that it was actually a pretty good piano. So dismantled it, and now I just have the piano soundboard and all the parts. So I have a piano soundboard in my studio, and then it's never going to happen, but if I wanted to put it back together, all the wood that encloses it is still in our garage, and the keys are hanging in a different wall of the house.
Did you ever end up burning up a piano?
I have not burned up a piano.
It's not too late.
I know, I could still... Well, and I also want to dump one in a river and record it decomposing there. That would be fun, too. But the other story about burning things... Julie Keefe, who is Portland's creative laureate. I was at Caldera, which is in Near Sisters, has an artist residency every year, and... Back a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or so, I was one of the artists in residence, and so was Julie Keefe. And she had these great big... there had been a fire that had come through a few years previous, and they'd created, from all the dead trees, they'd had to cut down the dead trees and put them in piles. And she collected a bunch of artists together to make an art project out of burning those piles. And so she wanted to take photos. She had filmmakers. She had pottery, people who did pottery. She had lots of musicians and other things. And so I created a bunch of microphones to stick in the fire to burn, to see if we could capture the sound of them burning up. I got a couple of really interesting recordings out of that. And it was fun to try and build things that would last long enough to not burn up and also to collect sound.
Where do you think that challenge in you know, as an artist and a musician, like that challenge of, well, what would it sound like? Can I do this? Where does that come from inside you? Do you know?
When she said, I'm going to burn up these piles, you know, do you want to do something? It was very much like, you know, and I mean, other musicians came and wrote songs and did very, you know, wonderful, wonderful creative things, but also very, you know, more traditional things. Other people did experimental things, but, you know, she said, I'm looking for you as a composer and I'm going to burn something. And I'm like, well, then I'm
in.
I need to get the burn sound. That's, you know, that's the connection. You know, it's like I thought about it less than everybody else almost. You know, in Anaya Lockwood's Burning Pianos, I'm like, I want to do that. I can do that. It's sad to destroy a functioning piano, but there's a lot of people who have pianos that apparently are no longer nearly functioning. So
right, they're not in use. So for you, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the act of creation, it's the creating, the building up to it, the creating, and then moving on to the next building and creation.
So
because I mean, you can capture the sound, you know, for, I'm making air quotes, posterity. But I'm not getting the sense that after you're done that you are listening to it you know, so much that you're moving on to the next challenge, the next project.
I think that's true. I know in our car, we've got a USB stick full of music, including Brian Eno and Anaya Lockwood and such, and it has a bit of my music on it. And if I'm in the car, when my music comes on, I'm like, it makes me feel nervous and I don't want to listen to myself. I want to listen to other people's stuff, you know. I want to hear what other people are doing. I have already done that thing that, you know.
Do you listen to non-experimental music? Do you listen to other artists? Who do you like to listen to?
I've been listening to a fair amount of Shonen Knife. I tend to listen to punk. I tend to listen to Team Dresh, Bikini Kill, Sleater-Kinney.
Okay.
So, you know, I'll always listen to Storm Large because she's, you know, local, fantastic,
she's
amazing.
Storm Large.
Because she's Storm Large.
Tell me about the 10 tiny dances that you did for the time-based art.
Okay.
The time-based art festival.
Time-based art festival is awesome. I love it. It's one of the best things you can do. It's something I look forward to every year in Portland. So Mike Barber is a local choreographer. He's put together a series of things, a series that's been done, I don't know how long he's been doing it for, a while, where he has 10 performances that are all under 10 minutes that are performed on a 4x4 stage. And so Electra Gals was doing a benefit show, and we decided to hook, we did a mini 10 tiny dances, we did 5 tiny dances. So we hooked up 5 composers with 5 five dancers and choreographers, and did the music for their piece on the stage. And what I ended up doing, and then we did this for this Electra Gals benefit thing, and Mike Barber asked if we could do the same piece again at the Time Based Art Festival. But basically what I did was I took a bunch of green laser beams, and I'll talk about the version I did at TBA rather than the one I did for the Electra Gals thing. So we hooked them up to the rafters of Washington High School, and the reason we use the green ones is because when the lights are off, you can actually see the beams. And so then the dancer, as she's moving through these beams of light, she's breaking the beams of light, and that was making the music. That was changing the music. She would move her arm through this beam, and it would sound like something was breaking.
Oh, so the music was being controlled by the light.
Exactly.
So that, and you made that?
I did. And I used my brother. I was going to say my little brother, but he's actually a good few inches taller than me. My little brother has worked for a very long time for a company called Veneer. But they're in Beaverton, and they make science equipment. And so they had the sensor that when the laser hit the sensor, then it sent data. So then I just had to hack the sensor. So I borrowed, although then they gave them to me, but I borrowed a bunch of their sensors so that I could get that data to talk to an Arduino that would then send the data to my computer with his help.
That's so cool. Have you ever thought of, you know, doing it a large-scale installation at Burning Man?
That would be fun. That would be a lot of fun.
They do have grants, you know.
Oh, do they? I did not know that.
Oh,
that could
be
interesting.
Many of the large installations or projects, yes, they help to subsidize, not completely, but subsidize many of the art exhibits and interactive exhibits that you see at Burning Man. So
okay.
I would really encourage that, because there you have a scale that is hard to find anywhere else. I can totally see that. Just seems like such a great match. You know, there is no real limitations on size of anything.
Right.
Which is hard to find.
I competed in a musical instrument building thing a few years back, and a bunch of people I was competing against had done stuff at Burning Man. That was which I knew Burning Man had and it was really cool to see all their stuff, but I knew it had lots and lots of musical components, and it was kind of fun to see it out in, you know, out in a slightly different environment.
And a lot of I mean, there are a lot of installations where people, you know, that are designed for interaction. Like, I can think of one where there was a tree, and I think there were monkeys kind of in the tree, around the outside of it, and you would come up and like play. They had drums or something that was like a drum, or pads maybe, around the tree so that multiple people could play at the same time.
Oh, cool.
And then depending on what people were doing, and it is a lot, at least 12, that would control the monkey spinning around and doing things in the tree.
Cool.
So that's, you know, an example. There are a lot of participatory art and light, sound, activities and installations that people put together.
That it sounds like a good lots of good fun.
I'm Rabia Yaman. This is The Digital Divide, and we're talking with Christy Denton, Portland-based composer and electronic artist. Well, you're a woman, and you're a woman in an electronic music field. I'm not hearing that you have limitations, but talk a little bit to that. Being a woman, is the electronic music field, is it predominantly male? Is it hard to get heard?
I went to Mills College. Mills College is a women's college. It's got Center for Contemporary Music in it, with a bunch of grad students. The grad students are co-ed, which meant that there were, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it seems like there were about 100 men and 4 women in the program, and I'm at a women's college, you know? So it was, and that was 90s. Things, I'm certain, you know, things have changed, and my 100 number is probably too large, but, you know, you certainly get comments like, I didn't know girls did things like that, or women, or, you know, what, you know, are taken aback occasionally. Not,
I didn't know women want to burn up pianos and record what it sounds
exactly
like. Shouldn't you be, like, I don't know, making a salad?
Exactly. Playing the violin. But I think that all being said, at least in Portland, and for that matter in Paris too, there's lots of women doing electronic stuff. There's lots of, you know, there's lots of exposure. There's certainly no one ever goes, oh, you're a woman, you shouldn't be doing that, or anything. You know, there's the occasional surprise that I am, but it's getting better and better, and it's really cool that there's so many people younger that are, you know, like, maybe going to Mills College, and maybe it's, you know, split a little more evenly now, or, you know, I feel like times are changing and that things are a little more equal.
Do you ever consider taking, and maybe you have, taking a mentor role or teaching?
I think to some degree, I mean, I think that's a great idea in theory, but in practice, would I actually do it? I really should. Then I also feel like part of being, when I was in my 20s, part of the reason that it was okay was because I had good women composer friends, and, you know, and now I still have those same good women composer friends, and do I have a ton that are younger than me? Not as many as, you know, as I'd like, I guess, you know, as I should, as, you know, well, and I think that's important.
There's two kinds of electronic, well, there's more than two kinds, but there's experimental, which is your area, I think, that we're talking about. And then, you know, there's beats.
Yeah.
And people refer to that as electronic music as well.
Yeah.
And I think we probably see more people going into that kind of beat-driven electronics, you know, DJing and which is a totally different, but right. It's not less, it's just a different way of, you know, composing and taking pieces as opposed to creating the actual sounds,
right.
Which is what you're doing. So have you ever had people not understand that you're not making beats, beat-driven music, that you're creating soundscapes and capturing sounds and collecting them and composing with them spontaneously and, you know, and not spontaneously?
Yeah, sure. And I don't think I do a particularly good job of explaining to people when I, you know, when I'm telling people what it is I do, I'm not necessarily, you know, because I generally say experimental electronic and they're like, oh, so you do electronic music, but you're not popular. So, you know, it's experimental, you know.
Are there beats?
Yeah. So I know that lots of people don't particularly enjoy, you know, some of my closest friends. I'm certainly not something that they would ever turn on. And that's fine with me. That doesn't bother me. You know, there's certainly different types of music that I listen to, and I'm not going to, you know, tell them they're wrong or anything.
Let's hear a couple minutes from this piece, and listener, beware, it's not going to be the music that or the sound that you may be used to hearing on the radio. But hang in there with us. This is, I'm not calling it artisanal. I'm not. It's handmade sound.
I wanted to say about women, though I have become more impatient in my 40s. Now that I'm in my 40s, I get really cranky when I show up to some experimental show or some electronic, you know, there are lots and lots of women out there doing it. And if I show up someplace and there's 20 guys on the bill and no women, I like, all 20 guys might be fantastic, and I don't really care. I mean, just like make a little bit of effort. Like, it's not right. Tokenism. There's brilliant women out there doing really cool stuff. Find one of them. It's not hard.
What I'm hearing is that the women artists are more collegial and more collaborative.
We're just friendlier.
Unfortunately, it falls on the shoulders of women. Try to break through those barriers that are predominantly male in the electronic music field and electronic sound field to make it more integrated and more balanced.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I was a part of Electrogals. I mean, I am a part of Electrogals. You know, I think in my 20s and 30s, I had a little bit more like, oh, this person put together a show and there's only one woman out of, you know, 10 women, 10 people, and, you know, they just don't know any women, and I'll go introduce myself and I'll, you know, I'll tell them about other people and I'll help with that. And then now recently I've just been like, or I could just not and just be cranky about it.
Just be cranky.
I think it's what you said earlier, and I don't remember how you said it exactly, but I just... Now I'm just like, it's not my job to solve your, you know,
right.
Your problem. And all of this makes it sound like maybe it's hard to be an electronic music. I mean, that there's lots and lots of shows out there in Portland where it is all men performing. And I don't think that's true at all in the slightest. Part of what makes me cranky is that you go to like 10 great shows. It's much, much better than it used to be. And
well, you know. Good. I'm happy to hear that. Do you have a website where people can listen to your music or SoundCloud?
I have a website that links to my SoundCloud site. It's christydenton.com, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-D-E-N-T-O-N.
We'll put a link to that on the Digital Divide episode for this program. Christy, thank you so much for joining us on the Digital Divide today.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time.
Likewise, and I hope we have you back in the studio and maybe sometime performing live.
Of course.
Yes.
It's time for the KABU News at Noon for Friday, February 9th, 2018. The $400 billion budget deal signed this morning by the current resident of the White House will greatly expand the federal deficit and increase military spending. It ended a short government shutdown that began at midnight last night and will allow the government to function for 6 weeks before another shutdown looms. It provides no protection for the immigrants known as Dreamers who were promised by Trump and Democrats that they would have permanent residency status as part of this bill. In a statement released just ahead of Friday's vote, the National Immigrant Law Center, NILC, denounced lawmakers' refusal to attach a clean DACA fix to must-pass spending legislation as another failure to deliver on their word and a choice to be complicit in the detention and deportation of Dreamers. With hundreds of Dreamers losing legal protections each day and thousands more set to be vulnerable to deportation in just over 3 weeks, Democrats and Republicans joined hands in the early morning hours today to ram through the two-year budget measure. The bill leaves nearly a million young immigrants in limbo. Erica Andiola, an undocumented immigrant and rights activist, wrote on Friday following the dead-of-night vote, "Congress has moved on. Democrats threw Dreamers under the bus again, and the Republicans chose their racist leader in the White House." A new report by the Guardian newspaper shows that California police collaborated with white supremacists to target anti-fascists for protection. Court documents uncovered by Guardian reporters showed that officers expressed sympathy with white supremacists and sought their help to target counter-protesters after a violent 2016 rally. The records also showed officers expressing sympathy with white supremacists and trying to protect a neo-Nazi organizer's identity. These documents came out as part of an ongoing court case in which three anti-fascist activists who were charged with felonies after protesting at a Sacramento rally. These charges come in the wake of one of the most startling police corruption scandals to date, which just recently revealed the Baltimore Special Police Force's extensive criminal involvement under the cloak of their elite plainclothes unit called the Gun Traced Task Force. In local police news, consultants want Portland police to prohibit officers who use deadly force from viewing video evidence from a shooting scene before they've been interviewed, stating that the Bureau needs to place a greater focus on whether an officer's tactics before a shooting complied with Bureau training and policy. Other concerns addressed in the report involve sergeants who don't retain their supervisory role but get involved in tactical action, delays in providing emergency medical aid to wounded suspects, and lapses of days before officers involved in a shooting are interviewed by investigators. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, February 9th, 2018. Tune in today and every weekday at 5 p.m. for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters in KBOO's Southeast Portland studios. For KBOO News at Noon, I'm Nicholas Shane.
When we are given an opportunity to share our stories, opinions, thoughts, and ideas in a meaningful manner with each other over airwaves, not only does it increase our collective knowledge of what it means to be human, but our stories also have the potential to influence the public dialogue. This is the power of KBOO. You can help expand the conversation, invest in future media makers, and join us on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fix It Fair on Saturday, February 24th, 9:30 a.m. at Madison High School in Portland. The Fix It Fair helps you learn simple ways to save money and connect with resources. Join your neighbors and talk to the experts about how to spend less and stay healthy. There will be exhibits and hourly workshops on water and energy savings, food and nutrition, neighborhood and community resources, weatherizing your home, transportation, a repair cafe, and much more, with childcare and lunch provided. Again, that's the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, February 24th, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Madison High School, 2735 Northeast 82nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood.